Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, this is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you again to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. As we have been reminding you, these shows represent a desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity, and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. We invite you to share comments and ideas with us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And if you would like to be part of the experience, we look forward to hearing from you. And again, a reminder that these shows are archived as podcasts as well on our website, jewishsacredaging.com. And it is a real pleasure to welcome a whole group to our first segment here on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. We'd like very much to welcome Dr. Eric Kramer, Dr. Stuart Bagatelle, Kelly Kintz, a social worker, and my colleague, Rabbi Anthony Fratello. They are in beautiful South Florida, I think in Boynton Beach, and they're here to talk about a brand new book that they just put together as a collaborative effort called Permission to Die, Candid Conversations About Death and Dying. Gentlemen and lady, welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. It's a pleasure to have you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This book is a collaborative effort. It's a work of, I would say, real respect and love, having read about it, having read the book. Can you just, Rabbi Fratello, just real quickly tell me how this evolved? I mean, you just weren't sitting around one day at Dunkin' Donuts saying, hey, let's write a book about death.
We sort of were, only it wasn't Dunkin' Donuts. The four of us were serving together on an ethics committee at a local hospital. And after one of the meetings that we had, we began to have discussions about experiences that we'd had with patients or congregants or clients. And we realized that each of us were telling very similar stories. And one of us said, you know, gee, there should really be a book about this. And then someone else said, well, we should be the ones to write it. We all kind of laughed about that. And then a few days later, I think it was Kelly, sent around an email to the four of us and said, you know what, that's not such a bad idea. Because each of us have certainly had these critical kinds of conversations with patients and friends and loved ones and clients. And, you know, this book grew out of that conversation.
So this is a book that really speaks to personal stories, personal encounters. Let's make sure that people understand this right away. Kelly, if somebody wants to get a hold of this book, how do we do this? Is it through Amazon? Is it through bookstores? Tell us how to get a hold of it, and if there's a website associated with it.
Certainly. Thank you, Rabbi. So our book is available on Amazon.com, and to find it, you would search Permission to Die, Candid Conversations About Death and Dying. To contact us as a group of authors, you could reach out to us via Seek Publishing, that's S-E-A-K, publishing.com, or via our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Seek, S-E-A-K, publishing.
And so I would imagine the four of you or segments of it are available to organizations, congregations, et cetera, to come and present around the book. I would assume that, correct?
Yes, we are. Thank you. We do have many events scheduled between now and April. We are available to speak at local congregations as well as healthcare agencies, and we look forward to connecting with our readers.
Thank you. Dr. Kramer, in the beginning of the book, you talk about this idea of the acceptance of one's death as a requirement for successful aging. Could you unpack that a little bit? Because I think there are certain aspects of the society that repress that.
Sure. As the conversations that we had started to unfold, it becomes pretty evident and obvious. And part of the impetus for writing the book is that of all the things we can talk about, the one thing no one can talk about, no one is comfortable with, there's really no place to go. Maybe a rabbi, maybe somebody else, to get advice and think about the concept that a person is going to at some point die. Successful aging is something I talk about a lot as a neurologist. We deal with diseases and conditions of older folks, and many folks, especially down here in Florida, do incredibly well, well into their 90s. But the psychologic and mental health and the body health really is better when people can understand that there is an end and can plan for it and make a peace for it, and also do that with their loved ones and family.
The work that we do at Jewish Sacred Aging talks a lot about the challenge of really accepting one's own mortality and finity. In your experience, and I'll just throw this out to all of four of you, the American society, despite everything, we're still facing a real, the old Jessica Mitford book from when we were younger, a denial of really acceptance of mortality. We camouflage, we sort of like play games with death, don't we? I mean, we still haven't, as a society, understood. We're still kind of predominantly a youth culture. Would you, in your work, I mean, are you finding this, or are you finding society changing with a more acceptance and appreciation of end-of-life issues?
So this is Stuart Bagatelle. Thank you, Rabbi, for having us. So in one of the chapters of our book, I quoted Kurt Vonnegut, who wrote a short story called Fortitude, and this was probably back in the 70s that he wrote it. And, you know, this was, you know, now the time of the coming of the intensive care units and all of these, you know, great technological advances that could keep people alive longer and longer. And I feel like people, when they come into the hospital, fully expect that they're going to just return to their normal everyday life like nothing's ever happened. And when it doesn't go the way that they hoped for or planned for, you know, there's this great surprise. And I think, you know, we as health professionals need to do a better job at setting realistic expectations for what we can and cannot do, and quite frankly, what we should and should not do. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And I think a lot of times we're faced with situations where we just go along with the flow and really, I think, feed that
right.
Misconception.
It's Eric Kramer again. And so much of this goes to your question of people being able to even talk about, are we going to die? No, I don't think that we've made any advances in people accepting the fact that they are going to die. When we discuss things with patients, with clients, it's never a topic that people are comfortable with. It's almost as if having the conversation, we're all afraid that we're going to die. Nobody writes a will. If you write a will, you think, oh my goodness, I'm going to perish the next day. It's something that we all need a lot of work on to be able to even conceptualize and embrace the concept of death. And if you can do that, if we can do that, it doesn't mean we want people to die or we're going to enhance death, but it's incredibly freeing for people to be able to live that successful life.
What do you mean by freeing?
I would use the freeing term in terms of emotionally, in terms of spiritually. Akel wants to chime in.
Yes, Rabbi, I'd like to add, one of the things that we've talked about as a group of authors, especially with our work in the hospital and hospice environments, is that the fight between palliative care versus curative care is still in existence. And we see psychological, emotional, and dare I say, spiritual pain in our patients and their families that are not accepting of a terminal illness or not accepting of the fact, and it is a fact, that they aren't able to survive whatever their diagnosis is. And the difficulty and the challenge is that pain permeates not only the patient, but their families, and of course that family word extends to sometimes generations. And we fight with them and for them and attempt to support them, and yet the reality is that transition between accepting that curative pain, or excuse me, that curative work is not possible, and accepting that palliative care is appropriate, brings a sense of peace that is truly palpable to us, not only as clinicians, but of course to the patient and the family as well. In our work in the hospital environment that we're all very familiar with, at one point, there was a hospice unit, and it was extremely spiritual, and I do say that, a spiritual experience to actually walk across that doorway, because what you would find is the patients there were no longer fighting something that they weren't going to win. They were actually accepting and at peace. And once they have that sense of peace, that they radically accept that their life is terminal, then that psychological and spiritual growth goes to the family as well.
Can I add one piece to that? It's Rabbi Fratello again. In my practice, I've encountered lots of families where they've never had conversations about what somebody wants when they die, what kind of service they want to have, where they want to be buried, what they're going to do with their worldly possessions, what type of an ethical will or an ethical legacy they want to leave behind. And it becomes incredibly frustrating and painful for that family to have to make all those decisions without any guidance, without any wisdom. On the other hand, I've seen plenty of instances where other families who have made lots of decisions, who've made lots of choices, who've had these conversations as difficult as they may be, and it is very liberating, it is very freeing, because families can then focus on dealing with the emotions and the reality of what they're facing and not having to deal with all kinds of logistics, which are painful and antiseptic and really not what you should be focused on in a time of loss.
Well, Rabbi Fratello, several of you have mentioned the word spiritual, and in the context of freeing and this conversation being liberating. So let me try to follow up on that, because these words come up all the time in workshops that we do in Jewish Sacred Aging on decision-making at the end of life from a Jewish perspective. So could you comment on this issue of acceptance versus surrender? There seems to be sometimes, and maybe in between the spaces of the words that you were talking about, this idea, if I surrender to this finality, it's a sign of weakness, as opposed to accepting this and then accepting one's mortality, being able to move on. And could you guys comment on this difference with acceptance versus surrender, and if surrender in our society has such a negative connotation, as if I'm giving up?
Sure. This is Rabbi Fratello again. I want to say that it was not the goal of the four of us when we wrote this book to write solely from one religious perspective or another. We come from different faith traditions. We come from different backgrounds. And our hope is that our work is applicable to all peoples and all faiths,
right,
and
right,
all traditions. Speaking as, is my purview from the Jewish perspective, one of the things I've always found that's been profoundly beautiful in the Jewish tradition is that Judaism recognizes that death is just another part of life. It's not to be welcomed necessarily. It's not certainly to be celebrated, or it's not something we strive for, but it's something that we are very accepting of, understanding that, what's the old joke? None of us gets out of here alive. So I think there's a difference between surrender and acceptance. Surrender comes, I think, when you don't want to fight, or you don't have the will to fight, or you don't have the courage to fight. Acceptance, I think, is a profoundly brave thing, because it says, I'm aware of the reality that's happening, and I understand that this is my destiny at this time. And I'm making my peace with that. I'm accepting of that. And I think there is a profound difference. I know in the world of medicine, it's very different, because Dr. Bagatelle's job and Dr. Kramer's job is to put death off as long as possible. So they're in a different kind of battle than I am, or that Kelly is to a certain extent. Which is that when somebody is in a position where there is no further course of treatment or there are no other opportunities, how do they then move on to that next stage?
And I would add that I think, just to be very succinct, that I think the difference between surrender and acceptance is dignity. I think that surrender is a passive, as Rabbi was saying, to accept allows a person or a family or a culture or a group to stop denying, and we keep talking about this, stop denying the inevitable, but to celebrate the life and to celebrate the time that people have together and to take the time to get beyond trying to fight something which is not a winning battle.
And this is Dr. Bagatelle again. So, you know, I spent 9 years of my medical training, both, you know, medical school and postgraduate training in that wonderful city. And I got to see the way they celebrated death, you know, these parades in the street and the, you know, the music and the brass bands and these big parties. And it was just a wonderful tradition that I got exposed to. And I wonder if there's a way for me as a Jewish doctor to one day incorporate maybe some of those aspects into my into my plans and maybe my family's plans. So
I assume
just
you're talking about
of,
New Orleans, not Philadelphia.
No, not Philadelphia. This is Dr. Stu Bagatelle. That was Dr. Kramer before speaking. He's the Philadelphia guy.
No, but you're talking about the New Orleans, if I'm not mistaken, some of that tradition of the bands and the
session. Line.
Well, I will tell you that and I don't know whether Rabbi Fratella has had this experience too, but what we've noticed is a beginning change in certain funerals in the last decade that have become more celebratory in a variety of different ways. I think it's a part of this gradual cultural change that we're witnessing. Kelly, did you want to say something?
Sure. One of the things that I wanted to add as Dr. Kramer and Rabbi Fratello and Dr. Bagatelle were speaking is, as a social worker and throughout social work school and undergrad and graduate school, we're actually taught to meet our patients and their families where they're at. And part of the challenge is we are not dictating whether they continue life support or whether they give the palliative tract of care their commitment. One of the things as a clinician is difficult is that's what we're taught, but we're not taught actually how to cope with the emotional pain that comes up when you're sitting at someone's bedside or when you're working with a patient or their family and they're dying. And so one of the additional goals that we wanted to add to our book is to actually be a comfort to those clinicians that are out there in the trenches with us, that actually sit with people that are making this decision and help them and guide them and sometimes feel lost and alone. And we're hoping that any clinicians or any folks that work in the spiritual field are actually open to reading our book and seeing that our journey is much like theirs and that they aren't alone and that some of the tears and the fears that come up for them are echoed in the pages of our book.
You know, you give this illusion of sitting with the bedside. For all of you, how important would you say, or your experience, is the power of ritual, religious ritual, in this last stage of life?
One of the things, as a psychotherapist in my practice, I am working one-on-one now currently with patients throughout the course of my day, and one of the things that we know from psychological research is that the process of rituals actually helps in the healing process, that it actually helps people come to terms with whatever the loss and the grief that they're experiencing. And not having those practices of rituals at a time of crisis, is extremely detrimental to their psychological and their emotional health.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Dr. Bagatelle, you have an image that I wanted to ask you to explore a little bit, because it's very spiritual as well as in many ways clinical. At least when I read it, that's how the spiritual aspect of this. You write that somewhere in the beginning in one of your reflections that the experience of, quote, working inside of one of God's creations, unquote. Could you just unpack that a little? It's a magnificent line.
Thank you. Well, you know, it was my first day of medical school, and I remember being introduced to my cadaver, and I had five other students along with me, and we, you know, worked diligently in the morning, you know, dissecting this body, and going to lunch and then coming back and doing it again. And it wasn't, I remember this very clearly, it wasn't until the third day I came home from school and I was with my then fiance and I just broke down in tears. And I remember feeling so alive at that point, thinking what I was doing, what I was getting my hands involved with. And I think, you know, medical schools nowadays might even be moving away from the cadaver lab with the advent of technologies that allow you to study anatomy and physiology without getting your hands dirty. But there was something about that experience that I think made it real. And I still have that vision of that man's face when we finally pulled back the towel to see his face and what he looked like and what he smelled like. And that was that's real for me. And that's what it is. That's what it's all about. This human this godly creation that we get to work with and interact with on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's a very the way you described it even just now. It is in many ways a very spiritual experience. And I've talked to colleagues of yours who teach at medical schools. We work with somebody very closely in Philly who teaches at Jefferson Medical. And there seems to actually now be in medical training a slight rise in the desire to have discussions around the spiritual path of even the physicians as they go through their training. Could you before we start running out of time for this segment, the issue of quality of life. I think Dr. Kramer in the beginning of the show talked about, you know, just because we have the technological ability to do something doesn't necessarily mean in a particular context that we should do something. And that opens the door to the question of how far the arsenal of medical technology can be used. And I know from the physician standpoint and certainly from the social work and certainly from the rabbinic or clergy standpoint, this concept of the quality of life comes into play. How do the four of you deal with this issue?
This is Rabbi Fratello again. This is a big part of the underlying reason why we wrote this book, so that families can have those conversations. There are some people that we've interacted with who want everything possibly done to be done. And there are some people who, you know, if they're given a terminal illness or something, they will say, okay, that's it. I'm accepting of this. I don't want any interventions. And, of course, there's all kinds of myriads of choices in between. If you've had those conversations with your family, if you've had those conversations with your loved one, then you can walk into that situation armed with the knowledge to make the right choices and the right decisions. If you've never had those conversations, if you've never had those discussions, then when you're suddenly faced with having to make very critical, very difficult decisions in a short window of time, it can really become a nightmare. Dr. Bagatelle.
Yep, this is Dr. Bagatelle. So, you know, quality of life is really defined by the patient. And so one of the first things I'll ask my patient who's dealing with an end-of-life illness is, what's important to you? What are your goals? And in the book, I write a story about it, having that very same conversation with my mom and dad. And my mom and dad both answer that question very differently. You know, my dad tells me, you know, as long as I'm able to sit and watch TV and, you know, see my kids and my grandkids, that's fine with me. You stay away from that plug. But my mom, on the other hand, has made it very clear if she can't wipe her own you-know-what, let her go. And so that's, you know, it's all down to what's important to someone. And just asking the question is the most important thing we can do.
Yeah, and in terms of, this is Dr. Kramer. In terms of quality and in terms of these conversations, one of my mantras is not to restrict this conversation and not to restrict the timing of this to the end of life. This is something that whether or not it's presented and how it's presented, even to a younger person, is important in terms of what is your individual meaning, what is your individual spirituality, what is your individual quality. We have, unfortunately, young people who have tremendous injuries. They need to process some of this, especially sports people. We have older people who need to have and learn to have the conversation. You know, by teaching, one can actually process the information in themselves by teaching younger people to address some of these questions. And then quality is a fascinating thing where I tell one story and the group has heard it before. I'll make it very short. I had a relative who, after she turned 90, was not able to walk, not because her body was a problem otherwise than her knees. She was a prisoner of her knees. She no longer had independence. Her children were in other parts of the world, very, very successful, didn't have anybody visiting her, lived in a very nice, but what she called the last resort. It was a resort, but what she called the last resort. And she openly would verbalize that her quality of life was nothing. Now, she would never commit suicide, but she would verbalize she was ready to go. And she was tormented and was actually forced in some ways to live for several years with what she openly said was no quality of life.
Well, you know, this raises a question that it was one of the questions from reading the book, and maybe it's a good way to start the conclusion of this particular segment. I think it was triggered by Rabbi Fratello's writing a story about one of the vignettes about dialysis, and I think dealing with the congregant and dialysis. And from that, and I'll throw this open to all of you, is there a position, is there a point, and you're alluding, the last comment alluded to this, when people are ready to die, they are ready to die. Could you comment on that?
So, yeah, it's Dr. Kramer again. Personal vignette. I had an uncle who had terminal pancreatic cancer, and the family had tremendous financial resources. And they went one place, and they opened up a new wing in a major university to research pancreatic cancer. Finally, and this was fascinating to all of us, after years and putting this fellow through bone transplants and all kinds of things, his wife looked at him and she said, "Mike, you can die now. I'm ready." And within an hour, he died.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are times that individuals are ready to die, and unless we talk about it, unless we respect that in each individual, I'll pass the baton.
Yeah, this is Dr. Bagatelle. I had a patient very similarly. She was diagnosed with multiple myeloma and was on dialysis for several years, and when we reviewed her end-of-life care plan using what we call a pulsed form, a physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment, one of the things she told me was, "I'll do dialysis, but only for a short period of time." And I said, "Okay, well, let's keep that on the back burner." And sure enough, about a year later, she decided she didn't want dialysis anymore. You know, she was done with it. And because we had that conversation a year back, it was easier for me to talk with her husband and really let him understand where we were. And she died peacefully in hospice a week after, purposely stopping her dialysis. And I thought that was really brave, and she was ready to die.
One of the things that I'd like to add is that our book is not about assisted suicide, and it's not about the death panels. What it is about is opening these conversations about what a patient's quality of life is to them and defining what their needs and their goals are. And oftentimes, and I'm certain that any clinicians that have worked in hospice or hospital environments can relate to this, oftentimes patients fight for what their families want.
Mm-hmm.
They fight for the goals that their families have stated or for the goals that their families are pressuring them to have. And there's a hospice joke about patients that are dying and the daughter or the son will go down to lunch and while they're gone, the patient will pass away. Mm-hmm. And that's something that any hospice staff member can relate to, that oftentimes our patients push for their families, that they continue to go on for their families, and that once they're given that break from that pressure, they truly do die. And so our goal is really to emphasize starting conversations about death and dying and really having these very open conversations that we have with our readers just to determine what individuals' goals are, not what our goals for them are.
Well, Kelly, let me ask you before we conclude this segment to review once again, as you did before, if somebody wants to get a hold of Permission to Die, Candid Conversations About Death and Dying, how does one access the book?
Thank you. So we are available on Amazon.com, Permissions to Die, Candid Conversations About Death and Dying. We can be reached at seekpublishing.com, and we can be reached via our Facebook page at facebook.com/ seek publishing. We also would like to encourage readers. We are looking to initiate 5 additional book clubs across the country, and they're led by a very select group of people. So anyone interested in applying for that volunteer position and having the opportunity to be part of our author group for our second edition can reach out to us via those links.
And if I'm not mistaken, in the book, in addition to sources, there is a page that deals with how to, you know, seek advice about book club facilitating, et cetera, et cetera. So that's
yes,
also part
you.
Of, and the guide, there's a whole guide, several page guide on how to develop
there is.
This book club. So it's
thank
a book
you. Thank you for mentioning that. There are 25 questions in the back of the book that are a guide to readers that would like to initiate a book club. We currently have 5 book clubs that are active across the country, and one of our book club leaders has just moved to Switzerland, so she's starting her book club in Switzerland, which is really neat for us. But we really look forward to allowing them to be authors in exchange for their volunteer work with us, and then hopefully with their feedback, creating a curriculum that we can take to local universities and medical schools.
Well, congratulations on becoming global. And
thank
to
you.
Dr. Eric Kramer, to Dr. Stuart Bagatelle, to Kelly Kintz, and to my colleague, Rabbi Anthony Fratello. Thank you very, very much. This is a very important work, and I wish you continued good luck and success in the expansion of Permission to Die, Candid Conversations about Death and Dying. Thank you all. Have a great
thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Shalom.
Shalom. We'll be back with our second guest, Carol Reskin, to talk about the whole some issues about dealing with being alone after these messages.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Shalom and welcome back to our second segment on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. And we are very pleased to welcome to the microphone Carol Reskin. Carol, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Carol, for background purposes, Carol Reskin brought to the attention of Jewish Sacred Aging in a very, very interesting and ultimately very powerful a column on our Reflections for Aging column on the JewishSacredAging.com website, an article about aging alone. She pointed out to me in rather interesting terms one day that the society talks a lot about people with families and children and spouses and cousins and aunts and uncles, and said, you know what, nobody's really talking about the growing number of us who have no spouse, who have no children, and we're really entering this third stage of life alone. And she wrote a piece for Jewish Sacred Aging that generated literally several thousand comments and has been writing absolutely wonderful columns for the last year and a half on JewishSacredAging.com. So we invited Carol on. Along with another individual, Holly, who sadly had to drop off because of illness. So, Carol, walk us through what this situation is that you write about, and the the looking forward into one's last third of life without that huge support system of parent, you know, spouses, children, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think you summarized it really well in terms of how I came to that point. I have been for a long time without family of any sort, not extended family or immediate family, no spouse, no children or grandchildren, and never really gave it a lot of thought until I retired, at which point a very busy life that was filled with people, because I was a human resources person and my life was people-filled, became very alone. And very honestly, it's very frightening. It's startling to wake up in the morning and not have people to talk to, not have a place to go, not to feel like I had a purpose. And the feeling of isolation grew, and it was very, very difficult to wrap my head around where I was at this stage of my life. At that point, I was still very healthy. I was very active. I wanted to be involved. And the aloneness was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. It was not anything I had planned for or expected or even thought about until it happened. And there it was. So that's how it all came about. At that point, I'm a reader and a researcher. I started to read about aging, and exactly as you described, there's such a wealth of wonderful material about how to age well and what you should do to prepare for aging well, including all the things like preparing your documents and an ethical will and creating a legacy, all of which are exactly what a person should do, except that if you do not have any family or any trusted close friend who wants to take on that responsibility, and you are alone, you don't even have the basics. For example, no emergency contact, about as basic as you can get. And it frustrated me, it angered me, it made me very sad that what I thought was a very growing segment of the population, people who are aging alone, were totally left out of the conversation.
So you write in some of your columns, and you've mentioned to me this concept of elder orphan. Could you talk to me about that and what you mean by that? And if I'm not mistaken, you've written that there's actually now an organization around this?
Yes. There are a few organizations. There's one in particular and a spin-off of it that I have recently become part of. An elder orphan, depending upon who you talk to, because the age changes. But it can be anyone 50 or older who is aging alone, without spouse, without family, and or without family support. And that is how an elder orphan is defined. There's a wonderful group that I have joined that's an online group, which is what they call a closed group. So you must have all of those qualifications. You must be an elder orphan in order to participate in elder orphans. And then there is a subset of that group called Jewish elder orphans, which are people who also want to address more specifically the faith-based part of aging.
These are Facebook groups, Carol?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Go ahead. No, it's wonderful because what I have found is that it's very difficult to get conversation around the concept of loneliness. Because as your previous guests were talking about death, loneliness, I think, is in some ways equally difficult for people to confront or admit. Because to say you're lonely seems to be, to many people, saying, I'm incompetent, I'm inept, I'm a social misfit, I'm not worth knowing, I don't have anything to offer. It's extremely hard to say I'm lonely. And it's not received with any degree of compassion or empathy. So to have a group like Elder Orphans where people can speak freely and understand that loneliness is a very big component of aging alone is wonderful. To have a baseline to talk to people who are in the same situation. And it's not always talking about the dismal fact of loneliness, but sharing other things, events and things in life and thoughts and ideas and a certain liveliness that you get when you know you're with people who are going through the same things that you are in life. It's a really freeing, exciting opportunity to connect with people who are more or less in the same boat.
Well, I know that every piece of literature, both popular and scholarly, that has come out around this issue in the last several years point out to the fact that one of the great contributors to early death is people's isolation, aloneness, lack of social contact, et cetera, et cetera. Have you actually, because this is, in essence, you're building a community, have you managed to touch base personally with some of the people on these Facebook communities? I mean, not only electronically, but actually, you know, face-to-face, meeting them and becoming friends with them.
Yeah, I'm starting to do that. Of course, this particular website that we're talking about is international, which is very interesting.
Right.
But I have, and I'm working very diligently now because I want to take this to a new step, which is to start to form a community. I'm working locally with several people who reached out as a result of my writing, and I reached back to them, and we're sharing a desire to do something specific about this. In my case, starting with very, very simple things, because depending upon where you live, there are some counties that have fairly good systems set up to get people around and to help people who are alone or elderly, and others that have absolutely nothing. But in talking to people, there were two things we identified that were almost surprising about being lonely and living alone that they really, really wanted to do. The first was to go to their house of worship.
Really?
And I'm talking non-sectarian now. Yeah, it's very, very important. Many people who are growing older had been active members of a church, a synagogue, a mosque for many years, but as they got older, as it became more difficult to get there, as friends died, as their feeling of connectedness lessened, or as they moved, because they had to leave their homes and go to other communities based on health issues or financial issues, they found themselves a newcomer in the house of worship. It is, very honestly, one of the most difficult places to go as a person alone. It is very sad. For myself, I would go to a synagogue, and there may be a greeter at the door who said Shabbat Shalom when I came in for services. Aside from that, I would sit alone. I would see all around me families, husbands and wives who were hugging or holding hands or just gently touching one another when there was a poignant part of the service. Sometimes they had their children with them, sometimes even their grandchildren with them. And to be sitting alone under those circumstances is one of the most alone feelings in the world, because here you are supposed to be in a place of community.
Right.
and you're not. And it's heartbreaking, and it really inhibits your desire to keep on going back. And the amazing thing is that you would think that, and I'm kind of recognizable because I'm an older woman with red hair. There aren't that many of us, so I sort of stand out in that way. And I would have thought that after a while, people would get to recognize me. I'm also pretty outgoing. I smile. I say hello. What I found was people smiled and said hello back, but never asked me really to join them because it was family time. And maybe they hadn't even seen one another all week, and they finally turned off their cell phones and weren't watching TV. And this was their time to be together. And I was the outsider, and I would take away from their time. And I understood that, but it didn't make me feel any better. So,
what was the second revelation?
And the other thing is sharing holiday dinners. The desire to, for example, go to a Seder. Or to have an Easter dinner or a Christmas dinner and even be willing to cook it and not have anybody to celebrate a holiday that's meaningful with you.
I think you just wrote on the website a couple of weeks ago about, if I'm not mistaken, about Thanksgiving.
Yes, and I got a huge response from people about that. Yeah.
What? Real quickly, what was the theme of what you were trying to express, and what were some of the reactions that you got?
Well, what I was trying to talk about is just what it feels like to be alone on a holiday that you would love to just be with somebody else and share. It's the sharing. There are people who wrote that, you know, they prepared themselves a nice little dinner and sat down with their cat or their dog on the couch, and it was okay. But things like that are meant to be shared, and it's not the same to get online and to correspond with people who are all over the world and say, I'm lonely because it's Thanksgiving, and they say, so am I. You want that physical contact. You want to hear the laughter. You want to see the smile. You want to give a hug. It's a very physical need, and people really want that. And it's very, very difficult to have holiday after holiday being alone.
Is there a difference between what you're describing as in the elder orphan category between somebody, let's say, younger, who really has never had a family, you know, as you've described your own situation, vis-a-vis somebody, let's say, 92 years old, who sadly has outlived a spouse and maybe in some cases outlived children, adult children. And in that sense, a different, in your understanding, is there a different type of aloneness there, or is the fact of one's aloneness as one ages universal regardless of the circumstance?
I think there are actually several subsets of aloneness. There are certainly those people who have the memories, who have the photo albums, who look back and miss terribly the family, the loved ones. And that loneliness comes with the memories of those people. And that brings, I think, a certain sadness that others can't understand, but it's their sadness. For people like me, who have grown up pretty much independent, I don't miss what I never had. That's not to say I don't understand that other people have it. But as I grew older, because my outlets, namely working and all the involvement in groups and things that I did while I was still of that age, as those dissipated, the feeling of being alone intensified tremendously. But in terms of my looking at putting together some kind of a community thing called Why Be Alone, the groups that the subsets that really stand out for me is that there's a tremendous difference between, and I'm not negating loneliness and isolation, and I just read an article last night that now doctors are being instructed to actually talk with their patients about their living conditions and about loneliness, because the isolation leads to depression, mm-hmm. it leads to early death, so many things. But the subsets that I'm mostly concerned about that are horribly underserved and really frightening are those people who are aging and frail and disabled, which is a really difficult position to be in.
And growing.
As well as those, and there's so much written about the boomers and how we are smarter and happier and whatever, and have more opportunities, which is true if you are financially comfortable and reasonably healthy, which is also not true for everyone.
Correct.
And so there are different groups of people aging alone, all of whom may be isolated and have loneliness, but some of whom have significant more risk than others because of limited resources of one type or another.
We have a guest also joining on the phone, calling in, Toby, who has written, has also explored this issue, and I think is also attempting to explore it in the future. Toby, are you there?
I am here.
Hi. So just real quickly, just introduce yourself, because real fast, and that's Carol on the other end.
Hi, Toby.
Hi, Carol. So my name is Toby Schwartz-Castle, and my company is Franks and Beans Events. So I try and help stem the loneliness, at least in my little corner of the world. I run events monthly for women. It's not a membership-based group. It's just anybody who sees what's on my calendar, and if it's of interest to them, they can register and come. Many times women come in groups with their girlfriends, but then there's a segment of women who I truly feel honored to serve. Those are the women who've recently undergone a loss, like a divorce, or their partner died, or they moved, or downsized, retired, whatever. These women come to my event solo, and I think it's my job, and really our job, because I have a wonderful team who works with me. It's our job to make sure that these women who come solo feel comfortable, and
how
we introduce them.
Toby, you run events, but how picking up on what we were talking about, how many of those women, and this is just are really coming solo by themselves looking for community? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, it's a smaller segment. I'm hoping for it to grow. I'd say about a quarter of the women who come, maybe a little less than a quarter, come solo.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of lucky that the women who don't come solo are very open to meeting new women and very nurturing to these women who come solo. I don't like to say alone. I like to say solo. And as I said, we introduce them to the women at their particular table. And you can see as the night goes on, the women are laughing. And at the end of the evening, I mean, these three women came to me at the end of a painting dinner that we did. And I knew that they registered solo. And I put the three of them together at a table. And these 60-ish women came up to me giggling and said how much they appreciated me bringing them together. And now they get together on a very regular basis for lunch, for dinner, for coffee. And that's why I'd love to grow the number of women who do want to come and either meet a new best friend or just a friend.
I have to ask you this question, and it may be somewhat politically incorrect, but so Carol has really pioneered a lot of this work, and you're running these groups for women, but a lot of the experience is also dealing with men who leave full-time work and are really, you know, also in many ways in a different form, isolated and very much alone. Have men reached out to you in your writings from the website?
I am so glad you asked me that question, because, and I may have even sent you a bit about it. A few months ago, I was writing an article for Elder Orphans, and I was asking people about loneliness. It was actually right after the article about Thanksgiving,
right.
And it was a follow-up to that. And I got literally no exaggeration, hundreds of responses and comments, which informed my my whole concept of what loneliness is in so many ways. Out of all of those, there was about 2% who were men, and their responses were very limited. So I decided to take a chance, and I found a picture of a man setting a table for himself. And I used that and with the headline, "Do Men Get Lonely?" And I wrote a little blurb. I would love to hear from some men. Do you get lonely? Is it not manly to talk about loneliness? Is there a difference between loneliness for men and women? And I got about 50 men who responded, a few of whom gave me incredible responses. In fact, I even noted some things down here. One man said to me, he said, the definition of being lonely, he said, guys like to do stuff. So he said, in his case, he went to meet up to try to join and become part of things. But he said, loneliness, he thinks, was the same. When he retired, he lost friends. He said he was lonely for children of his own. He regretted the decision that he had never had his own children. He was lonely for someone to share his life with. He said, just sitting on the couch, planning a weekend, cuddling. He said, yeah, Carol, guys want that too. And he said, even longing, and these were his words, for a connection to God or universe or faith.
Wow.
Again, not having someone to go with to a house of worship or something like that. And so it seems like it's a bit of a taboo for a man to admit to loneliness. It's not strong. But then again, a lot of us who admit to being lonely are viewed as weak. I think it's harder for men. I also think that, in a sense, it's harder for women because ageism, which is across the board gender-wise, is made equally difficult by sexism. And I think females have a harder time in general because you put those two things together. But men get lonely. And
right.
I was educated, and it was quite an experience for me.
We have about one and a half minutes left in this segment. Tilly, in your groups of and activities and programs for women, do these conversations about their own sense of searching and concern, economic stress and strain, do they come up at all, or are the groups mostly social in their orientation?
Mostly social. The women actually come to have fun, and fun is what they have.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's kind of their time to put aside what's making them sad.
Well,
and
Toby, I want to thank you because we're bumping up against the time frame here. So, Toby Schwartzcastle, thank you very much for calling in, and continued good luck with the groups. We're speaking about South Jersey and the metropolitan Philadelphia area, so I just want to make sure that people understand that. And Carol, continued good luck with the Elder Orphan work and the work that you're creating and doing and really pioneering. And keep writing for the website, because every time you do, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of responses. So we thank you for that as well. And
I will certainly do that. Thank you for having me on the program.
Thank you.
And to all of you, thank you for being part of today's broadcast of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows are, as we mentioned, archived as podcasts on both Blog Talk Radio and our own website of jewishsacredaging.com. Again, we invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com or the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. These shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And thank you again to Steve Lubetkin, our producer. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you for listening. Shalom. Have a great day.
Wow.
I I will. I'm going to post it on Elder Orphans and on my Facebook blog as well.
All right. Thank you. Take care, guys.
Okay.
Have a good one.
Okay. You too. Bye.
Steve, thank you.